Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert, from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to the remarkable John McAvoy, who turned his life around in the most astounding way. And the theme of the episode is how our environment shapes us. John McAvoy, how are you?
I'm really well, thank you. Yeah, I'm really well. I'm currently in Lake Annecy in France, and I've just started the process of training for next season. So yeah, I'm good. I feel in a good place. I'm just not that fit at the moment, but I'm in a good place. So it's just building that fitness back up and enjoying the scenery and the beauty of where I am.
You're out in the Alps, out in France, training, you know, Nike-sponsored athlete, doing various work for charities. Do you ever look back and think, where did it all go wrong?
Or where did it all go right? That's the question. One, I have a tremendous amount of gratitude for where I'm at the moment. And I know it sounds quite cheesy and a bit cliche, but every day I remind myself how fortunate I was to stumble across sport. Without sport, I generally wouldn't be in the place I am at the moment, physically, in the regards of the environment I'm currently in now in the French Alps. But just the amazing, incredible people that I've got in my life and I've had in my life the last few years in particular, that sport brought into my life. And I'm so fortunate and so blessed that I was so lucky that I found I had a gift when I was 26 years old, which has led me to being where I am today in my life. And yeah, I'm just... Every day I remind myself of that, Simon, because I think it's very important that you shouldn't forget where you come from in life to where you can end up getting and where I am at the moment and being in that moment and present and being really appreciative of where I am and how fortunate I am to be happy and contented with my life.
Absolutely. I totally get why you would be grateful. I mean, the journey you've been on is just unbelievable, and we'll dig into that. But just in terms of, you touched on your fitness, so you are an Ironman athlete and, you know, you've world records in rowing and all this kind of thing, but you said that you're building your exercise volume up. So in percentage terms, if 100% is you at your fittest, where are you now in percentage terms?
I'm probably about, I would say probably about 40%. For 7 days a week, I train. Some days will be much lighter than others. At the moment, it's a bit challenging with the swimming because most pools are shut. So I've been riding, running more. But yeah, like yesterday was a 4-hour ride. Today was a 90-minute ride. And then later on this evening, I'll do an hour run. And then tomorrow, I've got like an hour and a half run. And then I was meant to swim. I won't be able to swim. So I'll probably just do an hour on the bike. So I'm probably training at the moment about 16 hours a week. But that will go up. That goes up to about 35 hours by the time I get to like February, March time a week. So it's quite a lot. It's a full-time job.
I tell you what, if you're going to be cycling anywhere, though, particularly during lockdown, the Alps is where you want to do it. I mean, it must be just awe-inspiring.
Mate, I would honestly say in my whole life, like I've had some very pivotal moments that have really dramatically changed the trajectory of my life from extremes. And I can honestly say, mate, when I come out here, in my whole life since I've been on Earth, it's 36 years, I've never felt contentment and happiness in how the mountains make me feel. Like, I genuinely have this love for the mountains. And I think that probably comes back to, one, being immersed in nature. But because I wasn't free for so many years, I've never experienced freedom like cycling my bike in the high mountains. Like, and I'm not an emotional person. Like, I wouldn't say I'm overly emotional. But I've had moments where I'm riding my bike on my own and I've been out for 5-6 hours and I'm climbing up like a 3,000 meter climb. And I've literally started feeling like I'm going to well up because I feel so free and it makes me feel so alive and so happy and joyous. Like I can't express it into words how much I love this place and how it just makes me feel like I'm alive. Like And I think that probably ties back into all the years where, well, I wasn't free for nearly a decade of my life on Earth. Like I was in a cage. Like when you're riding up these mountains and you're in nature and you're immersed in it, you realize how insignificant a lot of the noise is in the world. Like I was riding up a mountain with my friend in the summer and that mountain's been there for millions of years and hundreds of thousands of people have walked up it. But the mountains stay consistent. It's been there. But all of these other people have been transient on the earth. And it makes you realize, in some regards, how insignificant we actually are in the bigger picture of the universe and the world. It just highlights and heightens to me that you have to live your life in a way where you feel joy and happiness. And the most important word is contentment. You need to feel content in what you're doing in life, whatever that is. I'm 36 now. It's took me to this point in my life to really feel that. Like I'm genuinely really happy in my life.
That's beautiful. Let's track how you found it then. Let's go back to the start. And I know in terms of your story, really it starts before you were born, doesn't it?
So my life has been very unusual before I even took a breath on this earth. So my biological father died next to my mum in bed. And my mum was 8 months pregnant with me. And he had an undiagnosed heart condition. He was a workaholic. My mum said that he used to work 16, 17-hour days. He ran multiple different businesses. Then he owned nightclubs. So then he was working in the day, running his businesses as a property developer. And at night, he was going to the nightclubs, wasn't coming home until 2 a.m, having a few hours sleep, getting up next morning, back on the building sites, making sure everyone was working. And one night, at 38 years old, him and my mum had been married a year. My mum's 8 months pregnant with me, like I said, and he goes to sleep and he doesn't wake up. 1 month later, my mum had to then deal with being a single parent and I'm born into the world. So when I was born, my earliest memories of a child being little was I was loved, I was cared for. My mum had loads of sisters, so I had loads of aunties round. I had my big sister. I had a lot of females in my life as a child looking after me. And I was like that little blue-eyed boy, could never do any wrong. And I was so happy. And it was only when I started going to primary school that me having a dad I didn't know what I was missing because I just thought it was normal to have all these women bring me up. But when I went to primary school, obviously children would start asking me where my dad was because everyone's talking about how strong their dads are and they've got the best dad in the world. And people used to tease me at school. I remember it. And I went home and I asked my mum and I said, like, where's my dad? And my mum explained to me, she sat me down and she said, like, your dad died. And I would always say, Simon, as a child, I was very inquisitive. Like I would say, why is the sky blue? Why is the sea blue? I'd always want to know. I was one of these very annoying little children that just wanted to know answers to everything. So when my mum explained to me that my dad had died, I wanted to understand what that meant. And my mum explained, she simplified it. Your dad's gone to heaven. When she told me this, it really did. And I know I was young, but it did have a very powerful impact over me. Because as I got a little bit more older, about 7 or 8, I loved history as a child. And my mum used to take me to like the Natural History Museum. And every month there used to be these like little magazines that they used to sell in the newsagents called Discovery Booklets. And there was about like, they were for children. And it was like, you'd build puzzles about like Napoleon and Henry VIII and then Anne Boleyn. And you'd put all these puzzles together and they were like little quiz books in there. And I can just remember being a little kid and developed this real fascination for history. And as I'm reading about all these people that had died hundreds of years before I was born, they died like my dad had died. But I was reading about them in the present. Like they had done something with their lives of significance where they were remembered. And obviously I'm a young kid. I don't understand what legacy is, but I understood that these people died before I was born and they had done something with their lives, like they had achieved something. And that sparked something inside me that when I got older, I didn't just want to be average. Like I wanted my life to have a significance. I wanted to achieve something with my life. And sort of how this started then manifesting itself out was, again, my fascination around stuff was British Telecom. And I know it sounds quite bizarre when I tell people this, but when I was a little boy growing up, these British Telecom adverts used to be on the TV all the time. And then when my mum used to take me like out in the car round to my aunties and uncles, every street corner had a BT phone box. And then when we ran around to my aunties and uncles' houses and my mum's friends, they all had a BT landline. Like they had a complete monopoly over the telephone communication system. And I said to my uncle one day, how much does British Telecom make? And he said, they make billions of pounds a year. And from that moment, my dream when I become an adult was to own British Telecom. And I wanted to be a businessman and I wanted to own BT. That was what my dream was. And if anyone asked me, said, what do you want to do when you get older? It was, I want to own British Telecom. And everyone used to laugh at me. But that is what I wanted. And I really think it said a lot about my character that I was a ferociously ambitious little child. That when I got older, layering on the fact that I knew I wasn't going to live forever, and then layering up, then I then attached success to money and having lots of money. Then what happened next, you can only really say was the perfect storm for me to go down the wrong path in life.
That wanting to take over BT, what was that about, do you think?
I think like this was what one of the biggest issues when I was little, how it manifested itself. I think by growing up in the 1980s, and I'm showing my age, but that sort of fixation on the I, the individual, it was all about the acquisition of wealth. And see, to me, money was never about buying stuff. It was never about accumulating stuff, watches, cars. It was always about like the goal setting was, to me, money was a gauge of my success in society. Yeah. And the more I acquired, the more successful I was going to be deemed to be a person. It was my own personal goals of accumulating wealth, because to me, wealth meant I was successful in my life. And I thought by having lots of money would be my legacy in life. That's what I thought. I thought when I'm no longer around, if I amass all this money, when I go, everyone will go, he was a very successful man. He did this and he did that.
And that's a common idea. That's a very widespread idea.
Totally. Yeah, totally. And again, mate, it took me till I was 26 years old to have that awakening of what I put my value system on, what was important in life and what really isn't that important in life.
Yeah. Right. Let's skip forward then. Now we've established that it was about money in the scorecard. And actually, that's not very different to anyone else. But then at the age of 8, a man came into your life that meant that you did take a bit of a detour, if you like, from the normal way of trying to accrue money. That was the start of it.
Well, like, yeah. And again, to give you some sort of context, like my mum worked in a florist, she worked incredibly hard, like to make sure me and my sister had everything. She loved her job, but she worked her fingers to the bone to make sure me and my sister had a really good childhood. So when I was 8 years old, this man, and again, it was very unusual at the time because other than uncles, I can never remember a male coming into our home ever that I didn't know. And one evening, this man knocked at the front door And he come into our house, and I remember being in awe of him. He had jet black hair, white teeth, big watch on his wrist, immaculately dressed. And he come in, and I was looking at him, and we went into the living room. Didn't know who he was. He was a stranger, and I used to be a bit shy as a child, like I didn't really engage. And he asked me to go and make him a cup of tea, and I went into the kitchen, and I put the kettle on, and I made him a cup of tea. I gave it to him, and then I was just sitting in the living room as he was talking to my mum and my sister. And again, I was too young. I didn't really understand what they were really talking about. And then when he left, he patted me on the head and he gave me paper money, gave me a £20 note. And he was the first adult to ever give me paper money. When Christmas comes around, like, I just used to get Christmas presents and birthdays. I used to get birthday presents. No one actually ever gave me money. So when he gave me this £20, it was the most money I'd ever been given. Patted me on the head and he said, "You're a good boy." And he walked out. And when he left, I asked my mum who he was. And my mum explained, when she was 16, she got married to that man before she married my dad. So my mum was in her sort of late 20s, early 30s when she married my dad. But when she was 16, she grew up with this guy, Billy Tobin, on a council estate in Peckham. They got married at 16. And actually, my sister wasn't my biological sister. She was my stepsister, and that was her real dad. And again, I'm too young. It was too much for me really to process what my mum was saying. But what he started doing, he started coming around to our house more frequently. And that wasn't to have a relationship with my mum. It was to take my sister out. So he used to come around, pick my sister up, him and my sister would go out. And then he would ask if I could go. I think my mum didn't want me to miss out because she worked so hard as a florist, and my sister was going out and going to these nice places and restaurants and going on having these experiences. So when the opportunity arose for me to join my sister, I think my mum felt bad. She didn't want me to miss out on an opportunity to have a nice time because obviously she was going to work and she might not have been able to afford for me to do these other things. So Billy started taking me out and my sister. And again, we'd go to the restaurants and it'd take me to the theatre and we'd do this thing. I'm still a little boy. I'm like 8, 9, 10 years old. And what started happening, he started taking my sister out less and started taking me out more. And to the point where he stopped taking my sister out and he started taking me out. And people treated him very respectfully. He didn't queue for things. He had very nice stuff. And he always, always spoke about money. Always talked about how much money things cost, always had £50 notes in his pocket in cash. And again, being a little boy and you're seeing money, I'd never seen £50 notes until these pink pieces of paper. Like I didn't even really know they existed until I started seeing him with them. And the way his persona, he was charismatic, he's very magnetic. People were drawn to him when we'd go out. People treated him differently with respect. And it was only when my granddad passed away and me, my mum, my sister and my mum's twin sister went to clear out my granddad's flat that my granddad had this cupboard with drawers in it in his bedroom. There was these envelopes and I pulled the drawer open, saw these envelopes, put them on the bed and started going through these newspaper clippings. And they were from like the News of the World, the Sun, the Mirror. And Billy was on the front page of them all. And the reason why I never saw Billy till I was 8 years old was because when Billy came around our home that night, he'd just been released from serving 16 years in prison for armed robbery. And Billy was one of the most prolific armed robbers in the United Kingdom. He had 5 acquittals at the Old Bailey. He'd been shot by the police 2 times. He was a multimillionaire when he was 21 years old in the 1980s, which was a lot more than £1 million worth today. And he was literally at the top end of the tree of organised crime in Great Britain in the 1980s. And I then started connecting up all the dots, Simon, that all the money, the way people treated him, the way or how all these other men that I was mixing with conducted themselves, that were most likely all engaged in organized crime.
Do you think he thought that he could bring you into his world from the start or from early on? Do you think that was part of the plan?
I think there was a mixture. Like, so again, years later, my mum told me a story about him. When he was a young man, when my mum married him, he was a plasterer and he watched his father get murdered in front of him. And his father got stabbed to death by 3 men in a pub. And my mum said that that had a profound impact over him as a young man, that he went from being like a relatively normal guy that went to work to end up going on this journey of becoming a hijacker, where they used to hijack lorries into full-scale armed robberies, cash in transit vans, where they were stopping them and on motorways and cutting them open and stealing hundreds of thousands, millions of pounds. Now, I think, and he used to say this to me all the time, because he never had a son, and he had my sister, but he never had a boy. And I just do genuinely think we developed this relationship because I didn't have a dad and he never had a son, and the way that he saw his father get killed, I just think it was this perfect storm of, he saw me as some sort of like protege for him. He never had that child, like that boy. And I think the way that he developed and sort of got immersed into organised crime himself, he had like mentors. And I know this is going to sound bizarre to people listening to this podcast, because it's going to be quite an alien world. But it was like he went on an apprenticeship himself as a man that wasn't really a criminal as a young kid, but then started hanging out when his father died with more serious criminals, and ended up going on this sort of apprenticeship where he was being taught by older criminals how to do these armed robberies and this organised crime, and how to not be detected. So I don't think he necessarily thought I was going to end up getting completely immersed into it, but I do think there was an element of him schooling me when I look back on that time. And I think as I started getting more older, it became more prevalent. When he started realising that was the life I was going to engage in, he started really guiding me more heavily into that world, and he took me further and further and further into it. So from being a young kid, a teenager, I was hanging out with some of the most senior organised criminals in the United Kingdom. And I can remember, like, years later, Simon, for instance, when I was in prison, there was an article written in the Telegraph. And I remember being in prison and I was reading it, and it was talking about how organised crime in Britain had evolved over since like the 1960s into sort of like the Crays and the Richardsons, and how like then it evolved into the 1980s to like organised crime become more around armed robbery, and then in the 1990s, 2000s, then evolved into drugs. And then when it went through the stages of like how organised crime went from the Crays and Richardsons into more armed robberies, they basically listed four men that they said had sort of been instrumental in how that process of organised crime had evolved into armed robbery. And out of those four men, three of them were in my childhood. Sometimes it's quite ironic, but a lot of these sort of guys sent their children to private school. They had the best education that you could imagine. And most of them end up basically becoming involved in armed robberies or selling drugs. And they all ended up going to prison. And it just shows you that the environmental factor, what a profound impact. Like, even though some of these kids that I know, and I know now that are in prison still, they had some of the best education you can imagine because of what they were going home to every day, and how that lifestyle was encouraged, how they end up, again, choosing that path like I did.
Mm. Something I'm really interested in is, you talk about environment, for example, and people are easily get classified, for example, into good people and bad people. I always think of this, the quote of the guy who runs the National Rifle Association in America, and he says something like, "The only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun." So it's really easy, this binary good and bad. But if you think of someone like Billy or some of those other people that you had around you, it doesn't sound like to me like it was something innate. It sounds like it was just that various events happened and the environment that they were in led to them going down this path. If they'd have been in a different environment, they could have led perfectly normal lives.
I totally believe that. I would say to you now, from my own personal experience, from the characteristics I had as a child, if I'd have had a positive male role model in my life that would have sort of directed me into sport or directed me into business, like if I'd have had a Richard Branson or Seb Coe in my life as a kid, could I have gone on to be an entrepreneur? Probably. Could I have gone on and be an Olympic athlete? Probably. I had the ability, I had the mindset. I had the drive, the ambition, the will. But as a child, I was only exposed to people like me, because again, you only know what you know, yeah, by people that engaged in what they did. And I had that mindset. And again, it's something like, again, I know I just said it, but you only know what you know, and what you can see is attainable. So I wasn't exposed to like Richard Branson or Seb Coe, but I was exposed to Billy and all of Billy's friends. So I wanted to acquire wealth as an adult because I thought that was going to be success, and I wanted to achieve something in my life. And they showed me a way that it was obtainable. They showed me a road and a path that it was attainable. And then that path wasn't frowned upon. It was actually encouraged. And then you start feeding into the sort of the whole anti-authority, anti-system, being as a young person. And it's very alluring as a young person that when you see like grown adult men just have blatant disregard for any rules, regulations, laws, it's not applicable to them. As a kid growing up, you just get drawn to it like a bee to honey. You just get sucked into it. It's very, very magnetizing, and it can pull you in. And that's why when I go in and visit young people in prisons, you see so much talent and ability. The way these young people's minds work, like they are entrepreneurs. But what it is, the product that they're selling is illegal. Now, if these young people were given another opportunity to like sort of work in the city of London, and you taught them how to buy and sell shares on the stock market, their brains, they can do it. They have the skills to do it, but they need to be shown that this is a possibility for them, because they've got the drive, the will to want to do it. They want to set up their own businesses. But they don't understand, or they haven't been shown how that's possible for them. And they probably don't see enough relatable role models, that people from their community that come out the other side of it and go and do these extraordinary things with their lives, these positive stories. They don't really see them sorts of people. They see more people that are hanging out on the street corner, driving around in a BMW on a council estate with a 10,000-20,000 pound Rolex watch. And to them, that's a way out of where they're at.
At the start, you spoke about gratitude, and it makes me think of how grateful anyone who hasn't been in that environment can feel. Do you think then people are perhaps too quick to judge other people? I've mentioned to you previously that a guy I find quite interesting is this psychologist, former psychologist, Albert Ellis, and he talks about judging the behavior but not judging the person, because it's like that saying, what, but for the grace of God, there go I, that type of thing. So, I mean, what do you think about people judging others quickly for the things they do without necessarily factoring in that, well, if you were in that situation, you would probably have ended up in the same place?
Yeah, I've been very fortunate, for instance, over the years, where I've developed a platform where I'm able to express my story, and I've gone and done sort of talks before to audiences of people that at the end, I remember one in particular, one lady come up to me, and it took me back a little bit, but actually of all the praise I've ever received, hers stood out more than anyone else's, because she come up to me at the end of this talk that I did, and she said to me, "Do you know today," she said, "I really thought I was going to dislike you and who you were." She said, "Like, but after listening to what you've said," she went, "I totally understand how you've ended up in that situation, because I don't know whether I would have made the same decisions that you made if I was put in the same situation as you." And then she was very appreciative of her childhood and the opportunities and the access to the positive role models in which she was exposed to as a young person. And again, like when I come out of prison, Simon, I joined a rowing club. Like I can remember when I went into the changing rooms for the first time, and in this rowing club, it was full of barristers and police officers. There were some older rowers there that were judges, and they're working professionals that worked in the city of London. And I no one knew about my backstory. No one knew nothing about me. I didn't tell anyone about the records because I was so worried that they might Google me and headlines from some newspaper might come up. And when my story did come out, it broke down preconceptions, because by that point, I developed friendships with people. I was going around their houses for dinner. And now I don't know whether, if my story would have come out at the beginning and I would have joined, whether I would have been welcomed so openly. But what it did do to a lot of people at the rowing club in particular, it opened up their eyes that you can't judge people, because if they would have judged me, they would never have given me the time of day. I would never have joined the rowing club. They would have just blackballed me out of the club. And I would never have developed those friendships with him. And then they realized that in life, good people do bad stuff, but it doesn't mean you're a bad person.
And
I think that had a profound impact over a lot of people, in particular at my rowing club. And I got a lot of that feedback back from them about how they used to prejudge people. And I've had it like, I don't get it so much now, but I had a lot of judgment at the beginning. Even when I was doing stuff like going to schools and prisons and, some people would say, "Oh, a leopard never changes its spots." But obviously, the longer I've been out and the more work I've done, it's abundantly evident that you can turn your life around and you can achieve things in your life and you can be a positive productive individual in the world, and you can have a positive impact over people's lives. I deeply regret the stuff that I'd done years ago. I really, really do. And I think that's been one of the biggest motivations. Like, if I can stop other young people going down the path I'd done, because when those young people fail, they're not just destructive to themselves, they're a destruction to the rest of society. So if I can prevent one of them going on to do bad stuff, that means more to me than anything physically that I achieve through sport. That's what legacy to me actually really is.
Yeah, totally. And that's a journey that a lot of people go on through life, and it might take a long time. You start out thinking, what can I achieve for me? And then realize perhaps, well, a lot of people do, that actually the more you can give to others, actually where that's where the real treasure lies. That seems to be a recurring theme. And you mentioned the word society. So let's sort of get into then how you got up to speed in the criminal underworld, if you like. And you talk about a moment where your stepfather was in the car with you and told you to look out the window and made a comment about society and about how it functioned that, again, had a profound effect on you.
Yeah, so like we were driving and Billy had this Porsche 911, and it was a limited edition car, and it was the engine was de-restricted on it, doing nearly 200 miles an hour. Got it from Germany, and there was only, like I said, there wasn't a lot of them in the United Kingdom, so it really stood out, this car. And I remember I was in the passenger seat of the car, and we was driving through this leafy suburb in Kent, and we stopped at a red traffic light, and he went to me, look out the window. And then I said, what do you mean? He went, look out the window. So again, I'm a kid looking out. What? He went, see all these people, they're all sheep. Basically, they get effed by the system and we eff the system. Mm-hmm. And he started setting up this narrative about how corrupt the system is and how the system exploits like the working class and how like we exploit the system. Now, to overlay onto this, when you're sort of, again, I wasn't engaged in these conversations, but when you're with these older men that are in their late 30s, 40s, and you're hearing these stories about like police corruption, corrupting the system. And I remember my stepdad always used to say to me, everyone's got their price. You can bribe, buy anybody. And he always used to say to me as a kid, everyone's got their price. He used to mess around and said, what's your price? And then I would go, I haven't got one. He went, you have, everyone's got a price. You can buy anything. So again, this narrative started really manifesting itself into me as a person and started affecting my views and the way that I perceived what the system was and what life was about. So then my interaction with the system was when I went to school, my teachers then become part of the system. So I wasn't in trouble with the police all the time as a kid, but my teachers were part of the state. They're part of the system. And I really feel ashamed today. Like, I feel so bad because some of my teachers at school were amazing. And up to the point where I really started becoming more and more entrenched in these beliefs, I used to love going to school and I loved learning, like I said, about history. And my history teacher was Mr. Evans. And hopefully one of these teachers listens to it, Mr. Vickers at Kelsey Park School. They really stand out to me, Simon, because yeah. Like I just remember sitting in these classes. I loved learning. I loved it so much. But then suddenly like Mr. Evans became an extension of the state and he was authority. And I started then pushing back on it and I started being ruder, more disrespectful. I started truanting from school. And then I basically made a decision. I remember being there and I was kind of looking at these teachers and they were telling me, like, when my GCSEs were coming up, if you don't get good grades, you're not going to amount to anything. You need to get good grades. And they were supportive. They weren't just saying you're just going to be cast adrift. You're not going to be able to do anything with your life. But I was thinking, really, like, if I get an A star, when I'm looking at these guys over here, they're not academically clever, but they've got apartments on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. They're living in £2-3 million houses. They're driving Porsches. They're driving Bentleys. They've got places in the south of Spain. Like, you're telling me that's not like, so he didn't compute. I just basically, I'm not engaging with this nonsense anymore. And that was where like the truanting from school was started becoming really heavy, to the degree where I just wasn't going to school at all. And sort of, again, Billy kind of knew what I was doing and he didn't really try to prevent me. My mum just used to get so upset and she used to just really desperately tried to sit me down, and I remember, like, she said to me, this always rings in my head sometimes, when she said that I was an accident waiting to happen. And she said, if you live your life in the fast lane, you will crash and burn and you will become exactly like he become. But you're listening to your mum and you're listening to a man he's got everything that you want when you got older. It's very hard. Like, my mum was fighting a losing battle.
Sure. Was there a definitive point? I mean, was it a gradual process, or was there a definitive point where you were, you know, full into it? And then at what point did things start speeding up to the point where you first went to jail?
One day I truanted from school and I was upstairs in my bedroom and Billy come home. And I remember I thought it was my mum at first, and it wasn't. And I looked downstairs and he looked up and saw me and told me to get back in your room. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to be in loads of trouble here. And I thought he'd start going mad because my mum was getting upset that I wasn't going to school. And then he called me downstairs and I'd never seen so much money in my life. Like, up to that point, I'd never seen so much money. He's literally, the whole kitchen table had a mountain of money on it, cash. And I was just like, my eyes just lit up. Now, that was when I was kind of like 15 years old. That was the acceleration then. Because then I saw all this cash and I thought, I want that. That's what I want. And then my mum, again, got really upset that I wasn't going to sit my GCSEs. So I basically, to keep my mum happy, I went and did my GCSEs. I just turned up on the day and sat the exams. And I remember when I went to pick up my school results, my head of year, Mr. Vickers, was in the assembly hall, and I was the last pupil to turn up to pick them up. And I remember he had this big envelope and he went to me, do you want to open them and see it? Do you want me to read what you've got? And I said, you tell me. And I just remember he opened the envelope and he pulled out all these pieces of paper and he looked at me and he went, if only you would have applied yourself, what you could have done. And I still managed to get relatively like decent grades considering I didn't do any coursework.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said to me, what are you going to do? And I lied and said I was going to college. And at this point, like, he knew what my family home life was like. And he, like, in regards of, like, he kind of got a sense that if I basically fell off the radar, I was probably going to get involved in crime. And he said, look, do you need any help? And I said, no. And he gave me the exam results. And I walked down the end of my school drive and I ripped them up and chucked them in the bin. And that was kind of me. I thought, I'm not engaging with that. And I always feel it's quite hard for me to talk about this part because, again, I feel quite ashamed what I'm about to say. But that little ambitious boy that wanted to achieve something in his life, that suddenly I see a way to do it, I went and bought a firearm when I was 16 years old. And my stepdad found out I did that and he was so concerned and worried that I was going to start running around with guns at 16 years old. That in his head then, it was safer for me basically to commit crime with him and go and do stuff with older people than people my own age. And that was it, Simon. Like, that was literally 16 years old. I was then completely immersed 100% into that world of organised crime. And I look back on it sometimes, mate, and, like, I feel embarrassed saying it now, but I used to have a very good memory as a kid of memorising car registration plates. Like, I don't know why, but I just did. So, because I was so young, I would never stand out in a crowd. So basically my role was to drive around and case out security vans, making deliveries to banks and building societies and then counting how much money was taken into the bank. And then I'd just relay that information onto older criminals. And then I would go to like security depots with a camcorder and film the lorries going in to fill the depots up in the early hours of the morning in the woods on top of the depots in the suburbs. And then I would give the cassette tapes to older criminals to look at. And then I kind of realised that, like, actually, I'm not going to become rich by helping these people sort of make money. And that was when I then started doing it myself. And I got arrested when I was 18 years old for the first time ever in my life.
And straight into prison from that point?
Yeah, like, I was remanded into custody because of my links to organised crime. My stepdad, they basically, it was very unheard of at the time. And there wasn't actually that many. But when you're under the age of 21 years old in Britain, you can't be kept with adult prisoners. You have to be kept in a young offenders institution. But because the police believed that I was a high escape risk, I couldn't be kept with young offenders because there was no young offenders institution in the country that could hold category A prisoners. So I was then transferred to a male adult prison, maximum security in Milton Keynes. And that sort of just exacerbated the issue of me going into this environment around those sorts of people as a kid. And suddenly you're going in with all these international drug dealers and armed robbers, and you're walking onto a prison wing as a 18-year-old child in this maximum security prison. And all these men are like putting all this praise onto you to be on that level of security at such a young age. Then it starts feeding the ego even more. And often people say to me, how did you feel scared? Did you feel intimidated? And I didn't, because again, like when you're hearing all these stories of all these adults before you go to prison, talking about all these other adults that were in prison, saying about like the way that they never relented, they never broke, the system never broke them. I went in with that mentality as well. Like I was like the most disruptive, difficult person you can imagine in prison, because I had no respect for the prison officers. I had no respect for the system. So when they put me in prison, I was very rebellious. And again, you go into an environment with older men and they're giving you all this praise. So it kind of just exacerbates the issue again.
Yeah. And then you ended up spending a year in solitary confinement, which is obviously pertinent considering what everyone's been through now in terms of being locked down and everything. But it's fascinating how that was for you a way of retaining control. Just quickly explain that, because actually as well, that's that decision, as out there as it was and as almost self-punishing as it might seem to be, that actually was crucial for your development as well in terms of how things have since panned out, which is, it just shows you just don't know how things are going to go, do you?
No, you don't. And this is a part of my life where I've pondered, I've tried to psychoanalyze myself and the way, and look at life as, again, from that overview perspective. So yeah. The story that I'm about to tell you now is the absolute catalyst, should I say, in the regards of how my life is today. So as a 19-year-old, I was transferred out of an adult prison because they downgraded me from a Category A prisoner to then I could go into a young offenders institution. And when I turned up at the young offenders institution in Buckinghamshire, they basically said to me when I was in reception that I was going on a wing. And then when I went up to the wing, the prison officers, after 2 days, come to my cell one night and they said, we want all your clothes. And they wanted to basically strip me off and put me in this bright yellow and blue suit. So when I walked around the prison estate, other prison officers could identify me as an escapeless prisoner, because they said they wasn't used to holding ex-Category A young offenders. So they believed that I was going to try to escape from this young offenders institution. So again, being that very rebellious, hateful person towards the state, the system, when they wanted to take my clothes, I refused to give them my clothes. Now, when you're in prison, you don't win those battles. So they took me to the segregation unit. They took my clothes. They put me in this yellow and blue special suit so other prison officers could identify me as an escape risk. And then I was confined to cell, which means segregation, for 7 days. So when the 7 days was up, you're in a tiny 12-by-6-foot cell. You've got a cardboard chair, a cardboard table, a metal bed, and some foam on the metal bed, and that's it. And it was like an old Victorian sort of prison. So after the 7 days was up, they come to me and they said, when you go on the wing, McAvoy, because now my name wasn't John anymore. No one calls you John because I'm not in an adult prison. So it's my surname, my prison number. When you go on the wing, you're going to be a wing cleaner. Now, again, going back to the stories that I heard from my stepdad and all of his friends about when you go to prison, you don't do what they tell you to do. So when they asked me to be a wing cleaner, I then said, that isn't going to happen. And they said, what do you mean? You refuse another law forward? I said, when I go on the wing, I am not cleaning up after you all day. So they put me back in front of the governor, and the governor gave me another 7 days confined to cell. So when he did that, I remember when he did it, Simon, he smiled at me and he said to me, you're in my world, we're not in your world. And they put me back in that segregation cell. And I remember I was so angry. And when you're in segregation, they can't stop you from reading books. So a librarian would come around with a little trolley. You could pick books off it. And I just picked this book by Nelson Mandela. And when I was reading this book, there was a passage in it. When he was in prison, he used to smoke tobacco when he first went to prison. And he realized one day that the prison officers was using the fact that he smoked tobacco as a way of control, because then they could stop him from smoking fags if he didn't do something. So he stopped smoking because he said, I'm going to take that control away from you. So as a young man that was 19 years old, that was full of hate, I thought, if you think by putting me in this tiny little space is a punishment, I will take it away from you. So when they come to me after the second 7 days was up and they said, you're going to go onto the wing now, I said, I'm not going. And they said, what do you mean? I said, I'm not going. I'm staying here. And that was where I spent the next 365 days locked in a 12-by-6-foot cell. And I remember they wasn't used to dealing with it. You could see, like, they didn't realise. I think they didn't realise, one, how long it was going to go on for, nor did I. But I can remember Christmas coming round. This prison officer come to me on Christmas Day and he opened up the cell and he said, look, John, he went, do you want to use the phone? At least use the phone to speak to your mum to say that you're all right, because you've not spoke to anyone in months. And I said, no, because to me, it was like they were trying to see if I was strong or if I was weak. And I know they wasn't, like, when I look back on it now, but at that moment, when I was in that moment, that's what I thought. And I thought, I'm not going to break. You're not going to break me. So when I was in that cell, I needed to feel alive, Simon. Like, I didn't want to just exist. Now, I never done any sport as a child whatsoever. But when I was in this cell, I just started exercising. I don't know what triggered it. I didn't do it to become an athlete. I didn't do it to get a six-pack for aesthetics, to get fitter. But when I started doing these prison cell circuits, they made me feel alive. Like, I felt like a human being. My heart rate was up. And obviously, I didn't realize at the time, I didn't understand what endorphins were. But yeah, it just made me feel like I was a human. And I got into this routine and I started doing burpees, press-ups, step-ups, burpees, press-ups, step-ups, sit-ups. And then as the months and weeks progressed, I just did more and more and more. And eventually I would do like 1,000 of each exercise, 1,000 press-ups, 1,000 squats, 1,000 burpees. And that would take me like an hour and a half. And then I would then read for the rest of the day. And then I would never lay in my bed in the day because I never wanted them to think when they looked through my flap to do their checks that I was sleeping my prison sentence off. I wanted, and it was me again, wrestling back control of my body and my mind. Like, I thought, you can take everything away from me, but you cannot control what I'm doing in this tiny little space. And after a year, they open up the cell door and they just let me walk straight back out onto the street. And I can be completely honest with you now, I was 100 times worse than the 18-year-old that they locked up when I got released.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Because you'd been through this process of actually strengthening yourself and showing yourself that you were tough, you hadn't broken, the system hadn't managed to take you apart at all, you were like, I'm bulletproof. Was that it?
Yeah, totally. And it was feeding into all the role models that I had as a child. Yeah. So when I come out, obviously outside, people used to talk about the fact that what I was doing whilst I was in prison. So when I got out, that fed into that narrative. So when I got out, people respected me even more as that guy that went to prison that didn't break. They didn't break me. I did that sentence how I wanted to do it, not how I was told to do it. I look back, it's so pathetic. Like when
I mean, I take what you mean. In a way, though, it is, I have to say, it also is quite impressive in terms of the discipline required, because solitary confinement is considered to be the ultimate punishment in prison, from what I know. And you did use it in some positive way for yourself. I totally get what you're saying in terms of you looking back and thinking it was a pathetic narrative, if you like, that you held in your head. It still was in a pretty impressive display of resilience on one level.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was funny because a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a friend of mine about silent retreats. And I'm quite a social person. I mean, I'm in a social situation. I speak quite a lot. She was talking about these silent retreats, and she had gone on one, and she didn't speak for a week. And it made me think, because obviously I didn't intentionally mean to do this, but there were times where I didn't literally speak to people for months. Literally had no human contact other than open up my door, walk down to this hot plate, walk back to my cell and sit in my cell for the rest of the day, reading or exercising in the morning. And that was my life. But again, if I didn't make those decisions back then to start the exercising process and the journey, I would never have become the athlete that I've become today. And yeah. I didn't do it for that reason. Sometimes I'm not a religious person, so I don't believe in God. But sometimes you look and I go, is it destiny? Was my life meant to play out like that?
From that point then, I know you ended up out in Spain, didn't you? You were in your early 20s and it was parties, drink. I've seen a picture actually with you, with your best mate out there with your arm around him. You're both grinning, living what you imagined at the time was the good life. But then you came home. Was it just for a brief visit of friends and family, but then ended up being a bit of a longer detour than you'd expected?
Well, yeah, to be honest, Simon, I had a bit of a moment the other day because I went back to Northern Spain 2 weeks ago. I went to Girona.
Yeah.
And the last time I was in Spain, I left at the airport. I thought I'd be back within a week. And when I went back to Spain the other day, that was the first time I'd been back since I caught that plane. And I went back 16 years later. And it was quite, when I drove over the French border into Spain, I had this moment and I thought the last time I left this country, my life was so different to where I'm now returning to it. It was quite a moment, actually. I had a moment in the car and I was like, wow.
Was it emotional?
It actually quite was, to be honest. Yeah, it was. It was just, what hit me, I know it sounds bizarre, but what hit me is when I started looking at the road signs in Spanish and driving through, it just took me back to driving to that airport in 2005, leaving Spain thinking I would only be back to Britain for 1 week. I left as a criminal and I come back the other day in Northern Girona as an athlete,
yeah, filming
some content, riding my bike, running and meeting the Ironman world champion on the top of a mountain. It's just mad sometimes.
It is mad. If I'd have interviewed that version of you now, how different would it have been?
I wouldn't have been open and honest with you what I did. But I think if I would have met you out in a situation where we would have met each other, I think however you would form an opinion of me today, I think you would have probably formed a similar opinion of me years ago. My perception of situations would have been different in the regards of I'd have been far more guarded and I was far more concerned about people's intentions with me. Like, was someone an undercover police officer? So the way I used to interact with people would have been a lot different. So I found it very hard if someone knew that I didn't know who you was. And if no one vouched for you, I would have been quite paranoid around you. But I think if we would have actually just met on a beach, you would have probably come away from the situation. However you feel about me today, you would have probably thought about me years ago. And I think that was the big shock. Because when I was in prison, I remember a lot of prison officers and probation officers really struggled to get their head around the way I was. Now, that was quite detrimental to me later on when I went for stuff like parole to get released, because the parole board really struggled with it because they just expect you to go and be, again, preconceptions of how they think you're going to be, and you turn up and you're something completely different to what they expect you to be like. But yeah, but going back to the original question, yeah, I only come back to Britain for 1 week and then I end up meeting up with one of my stepfather's best friends, a man that come out of prison when I was 14 years old. The easiest way I can explain him, he was kind of like a modern day cowboy. Very well respected in that world. Tried to break out of prison 2 times. I've never ever come across anyone that lived as reckless as him. He lived on the edge. He was like a million miles an hour. Money, high octane living in the moment, a fragrant disregard of anything. So as a young person, again, growing up around him, I was in awe of him and he was one of my role models. So when I come back from Spain, I'm in my early 20s, he rang me up and he said, can I meet you? And I went and met him in a cafe and he basically asked me if I wanted to go and commit a robbery with him, or as they say in that world, a bit of work. At the beginning, I said no. I said, I'm going back to Spain. I'm not interested. And he told me the sum of money, and he said it was easy. And that sort of missed again. I looked at it. It was like a calculated risk. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it. And then I'll go back to Spain, and no one even known I was even here. Little did I know, what I just said yes to was the best decision that I've ever made in my life. And I just walked into one of the biggest police, Metropolitan Police's surveillance operations in London. He had a 100-man police surveillance team following him around, basically 24 hours a day. And I just walked straight into the middle of it. And 4 days later, I'm face down in southeast London with 20 guns pointed at me. I genuinely thought they were going to kill me. I genuinely did think that as well. I'm not being over dramatic. I just remember them running towards me with all these machine guns in an ambush. And they arrested me. And yeah, my life just got hit by a train. And it just took a completely different turn of events than what I expected it to do when I come back to Britain.
So this was in Eltham, wasn't it? Because I used to live in Eltham, actually, funnily enough.
And, yes, it was.
Yeah. And I've seen actually the video of, I think, you in the car, because you were driving off, weren't you? And then there is a bit of footage of you at that time. And
yeah. So when they basically went to ambush us, and I saw them before the ambush, and I ended up having a car chase with them, Simon. And I can remember all of these undercover police cars chasing me. Now, when I went to prison when I was younger, I didn't know what was coming. It was all new. But I remember having this car chase with these undercover police cars chasing me. I'm being deadly serious with you now. And again, this is not an exaggeration. I was fully prepared to die trying to get away from them because I knew what was coming. Like, I was not going back to that 24 hours a day locked in a cage. And I would have done anything to get me away from them. And I remember when they, obviously, they did catch me. And I remember being in the back of that police car. And the police officer that arrested me when I was a kid, when I was 18, he was on the arrest team to arrest me again. And he looked at me and he said, "You haven't learnt your lesson, have you?" And when we were driving in this armed police convoy to the police station, I remember he said to me, "Look out the window." And I was, obviously, I was sort of looking out. And I remember it was a hot sort of September morning. And there was all these like people walking around in the high street with like bags of shopping. And I just, he went to me, "You will not be seeing this for a long, long time." And what the story that I told you about with my stepdad with that car, and he spoke about sheep and stuff.
Yeah.
I remember sitting in that police car with those armed police taking me to the police station, thinking I would do absolutely anything now to swap places with those people going into Sainsbury's or Marks and Spencer's. Yeah. And then I just knew that I was going back and I wasn't going to get out for a long, long time.
And then you ended up in the highest of the high of security prisons. So you were alongside Abu Hamza, the 21/7 London underground bombers. Really intense. But let's just fast forward a little bit. So how long were you in these incredibly high security prison before the next seminal moment, which was obviously when you got the news about your best mate? Because just to sort of add a bit of context from what I know, but as well, because even though you were looking out the window thinking the people you'd written off as sheep, you'd want to swap places with them, still, even though you were in this situation with some of the most well-known criminals, you still were not thinking at this point, I would change my ways and become one of these people. So yeah, what was the timeline between that and then that moment that everything changed?
Yeah, so the first 2 years I was in there, I went back to prison. Because of the risk level, they basically thought my escape was going to be imminent because they believed that I had the money, means and capability to be able to escape from lawful custody. So my escape must be made impossible. So because of that, I was in the British prison system, there's something classed as a double category A high risk prisoner. And that means that you can't be kept in general population. You have to be kept in a special high security unit. Hence why I was in there with the people that I was in there that you just noticed they were a threat to national security. I was an imminent escape risk because they believed people would help me break out. Now, because of those factors, that had then an effect on my sentencing, because obviously it had an effect over the judge. When the judge is sentencing me, in the whole courtroom is encompassed by armed police officers. The courtroom's cleared out because of jury nobbling and all these sorts of things like corrupting the jury and stuff. Mm. So I get sentenced, I go back to prison. But then once you've been on that level of security, it takes a very long time to unwind out of it, to sort of progress through the system. So I was basically in that level of security for 2 years, and then I dropped down to just a normal category A prisoner for another year. Now, what I realized was that they had basically made my escape impossible. Like, that was not even a consideration. Like, I could not physically get out. Like, it is impossible. They make it impossible. But I realized that, unlike the first time, because I had a prison sentence, actually like a fixed term, I had a release date. This time I had no release date. They could keep me in there for the remainder of my life if I didn't demonstrate that I had gone through a process of change. So the way you do that is by doing all of the reoffending behavior courses that you are asked to do by them. And then obviously, if you do all the courses and you tick all the boxes, at the end of that journey, they can't sit on a parole board hearing and say, well, you've not rehabilitated, because they've asked you to do it. So I went down the path of basically playing the game, manipulating it, just doing everything I was asked to do, victim awareness. I didn't want to change, because to me, again, being brought up, change to me was weakness. It was the system had broken you. You're weak. And I didn't want to change. I had no desire to change, no motivation to do it. I was who I was. That was my identity. All of my friends were engaged in that world. My ego was wrapped up into that. My reputation, my respect. People respected me because of the way that I was as a person, because of the way that I chose to live my life, doing negative stuff like that. My stepdad used to say to me, you're only your name. So if you're grass, you tell on your friends when you get arrested. That's it. You're done. So that was my motivation not to change. And it was only when my best friend died, when I was 26 years old. And yeah, it was genuinely like this moment that I had this whole epiphany, that this light bulb just woke me up in that prison cell. Because the way in which he died, like, he died in the Netherlands committing a robbery. He was one of these kids that I just spoke about a minute ago that went to a private school, had the best education you can have. His mum and dad went to work. His dad was a black cab driver. His mum works in the beauticians. Broke their back to send him to one of the best private schools in the country. But what they didn't realise that they did, they sent him to this private school where all these organised criminals sent their sons to school. So then when he's going on trips and at night after school, he's going around their houses, he's exposed to all these criminals that are multimillionaires. And he's then looking at his mum and dad. Dad's a black cab driver working his fingers to the bone to put food on the table and put him in a private school. And he's looking at all these multimillionaires that are living life, million miles an hour, all these nice trips. And he got sucked into that life a little bit later on than I did. And it cost him his life in the Netherlands. One night, he went and committed a robbery. And as he was getting away, the car tyre blew out on the car on the motorway. Car flipped. And he got thrown out of the car and broke his neck. And because it was quite a rare event that, like, four British criminals were in the Netherlands committing an armed robbery, it made news at 10, Simon. And I remember watching it in my prison cell in Nottingham and seeing the last moments of my friend's life on news at 10 on a CCTV camera in some little building society in the backwater of nowhere in the Netherlands. And it cost him his life. And he no longer existed. He never reached his potential in life. He never had children, never got married. He never really travelled and saw the world. He never reached the potential in which he had in his body to do. And then I sat in that cell and I had this moment of reflection, how pathetic what I thought was important in life was, and it isn't. And all the people that I looked up to as a kid, they were literally dead or old men sitting in prison rotting. And I valued their respect. And I just looked at myself in that prison cell, and like this little kid that grew up that went to own British Telecom, I'm losing on an unimaginable scale. Like, I'm literally losing my life. I'm not a winner. I'm losing on an unimaginable scale. Even though I thought I was in prison, I was fighting the system and I was winning, they won't break me. I realised how pathetic it all was. And I just wanted to do something else in my life. That moment, I knew that night that I just did not want that life for me whatsoever. But reality is, when you're in prison, you can't just get up and walk away and go to a new place. Like, I didn't have choice anymore. That gone. I'd given that up. So by me going to a prison officer going, look, I've changed now. I don't want to do this anymore. Can you let me out? It doesn't work like that. Yeah. So then I'm suddenly stuck in a place where I'm around criminals that don't want to change. So it's like being in a drug den when you're addicted to drugs, trying to get off drugs. It's nearly impossible. So I had to find something to remove me from that place physically and psychologically. I had to find something that could transcend me out of those walls, even though I was physically stuck there. And then the next part of my life, it sort of, everything just sort of dropped into place.
It's amazing. We all have stories and narratives that we tell ourselves about ourselves and about the world. And obviously you had this really strong one, and the edifice at that moment just completely crumbled. So from there, and you've spoken about the power of sport, and you had a guardian angel, it sounds like, in Darren, who I'm interested in you sort of telling me about. But yeah, so just quickly into the sport journey and how fortunate you were to discover this immense talent that actually did lie within you, that you'd sparked it alive, hadn't you, in that first time, but really establishing quite how talented you were in that area at this point.
So yeah, going back to when we were talking about when I was 19 in that segregation unit doing those cell circuits. So when I went back to prison the second time, that was my strategy. That was how I felt alive in that prison cell. Went back through the same process every day, 90 minutes. Now, my awareness of my athletic ability, now, bear in mind, I had no exposures really to sport as a kid whatsoever. I didn't know what an athlete really was. But when you're in prison, they have competitions over the Christmas. And when I was in one of these maximum security prisons, every Christmas, it's like the big thing. And the winner gets a tin of Quality Street. But it's the prestige of who's the strongest and who's the fittest in that prison. You've got a lot of guys that have been in prison for like, they can be up in there for up to 30 years, but you've got guys in the gym every day pumping weights. Not that many people do cardiovascular work in prison. Everyone's more concerned about aesthetically how they look and how strong they are. But I remember I signed up to do the fitness competition and I literally blew everybody away. Like it was just like, it was like a CrossFit circuit and no one even come close to me. And I remember the prison officer, and I remember him said to me, he said that because it was a nationally recognized fitness competition that he participated outside. So he could relatively see how quick I was in regards to other people. And then the next day, I went and entered the strongman competition in the prison, and everything was like power to weight. And it was bench press, squats, deadlift. And bear in mind, there's guys in there two times bigger than I am, like an extra half a foot taller than me, can lift ridiculous weight. But I was like the third strongest person per pound for my body weight. Now, I didn't realize, like now I understand I had this ability. I was athletically very good at something, but I didn't really, in that moment, it was a bit of masculinity, it was a bit of strength, power, like I'm not weak in prison. And obviously everyone's praising you, but you don't see the bigger side of it. Now, when I then started getting on a rowing machine when I was 26 years old, I got on that by pure chance because I was doing it as a charity row because I saw some other prisoner doing it. And it allowed me to have more gym time because you only get allowed to go to the gym between three, maybe four times a week if you're lucky. So you don't get access to the gym as much as you probably think you would do whilst you're in prison. So when I saw this guy down the gym 7 days a week, I asked him what he's doing. He's rowing this charity row, 1,000,000 meters, however long it took him. He was doing 5K a day, 10K, 12K, stuff like that. It was all added up. And I asked the prison officer if I could do it. They said, yes, get some sponsorship, which I did. Prisoners on the Wing sponsored me like 50 pence, 20 pence. I gave him the charity form. And then he gave me a special note. He writ out to say I'll come off the wing whenever I liked in the day after I finished working and I'll come down into the gym. And I started rowing. And I rowed the first 1,000,000 in a month. And when I was rowing, like I used to look at the numbers on the screen and it completely transcended me out of prison. Like I'd do like sessions for 2 hours and row 20 miles. And everyone left me alone. People didn't speak to me. And then I used to visualize that I was rowing on the water. I'd visualize that I wasn't where I was. And obviously you've got all the endorphins and it was just this very sort of like lifting experience. Like I said, it transcended me out of that place, that what I was searching for. It was like meditation. It completely blanked my mind for that 2 hours. So when I did the first 1,000,000 in a month, I thought, wait there, I'm going to do another 1,000,000, another 1,000,000. And then the prison said to me, you do realize 5,000,000 meters is equivalent to rowing across the Atlantic Ocean. So I thought it was a cool thing to do. And I thought there's more chance that the prison officers will let me keep going down if I say that I'm going to row across the Atlantic now, which they did. And when I was rowing for the fourth 1,000,000 meter after 4 months, the event happened. One day I was rowing 10,000 meters and Darren Davis, the PE officer, walked behind me as I finished. And he looked over my shoulder and he went, that is really, really quick. And again, Simon, like when you're in prison, you're in a little bubble. You don't realise how good you are at stuff because you're not in the real world. Yeah. And he come in 2 days later and he gave me all these pieces of paper and had all these world and British records and the indoor rowing machine. And I remember looking at them. And I knew at that point I could already break some of those records and I didn't think they were real. And he said, no, they are. They're real. And he just planted a seed in my mind. And I went back to my cell and I just thought, you know what, I'm gonna see if they'll let me do them. And I went back to him and then he went to the prison governor, deeply religious Christian man. And Darren went to him and Darren told me this story. Darren said, I believe if you allow John the opportunity to try to break some of these records, if he does it or he doesn't do it, I think this could be a massive moment in his life where it could be potential for him to really change the direction of his life. And the governor said, yeah, I approve it. And again, it's, I can't explain to you in that world what he allowed me to do in that environment was unheard of nearly. Like, he really did go above and beyond because they believed in me and they believed it could help me turn my life around. And Darren used to come in on his days off to sit with me to try to help me break these records. And he would bring me in books to read about athletes. And this was quite an important part, Simon, because bear in mind, at this point, I'm 26 years old. I was never exposed to anything really as a kid other than criminality. And then suddenly I'm 26 years old and Darren's bringing me in books of James Cracknell, Lance Armstrong. And I'm reading about all of these athletes that were world class. And when I'm reading these autobiographies, I had the same characteristics as a lot of these athletes, but I had never seen or heard of these people before. I didn't know who they were. I didn't realise that people that fought, I always used to think people that fought like me engaged in criminality with the same mindset I had. But I didn't realise like the will to win, the focus, the wanting to be good at something, the ambition, the drive. Like I'm reading these autobiographies, these athletes, to be able to suffer and push themselves. And then suddenly it's like, I've got these characteristics. And then I've applied them into something very negative. Now, if I switched them into something very positive, into sport, they could be massive attributes. Instead of destroying my life, they can help me build my life. And the first record me and Darren attempted was for the marathon on a Concept 2 indoor rower, and I broke it by 7 minutes. I can remember after I broke it, I was on the gym mat, and everything I wanted as a child, like that I attached to wealth and money, I realised at that moment how I felt on that gym mat after breaking that record was everything I ever wanted. Like, I wanted to be better than average, and I wanted to achieve something in my life, and I wanted to sort of feel like I'd have accomplished something. And I felt like that moment. And that's when I become absolutely consumed. When I got released, I was going to be an athlete. Absolutely, absolutely consumed. I would go down to the prison library. I'd start reading books on sports and nutrition, on training, on heart rate zones, heart rate monitors, how to get my body strong, understand about sports nutrition. Like I wanted to build myself and use my body as a vehicle to get me away from that negative toxic life that I was engaged with and help me break away from it once I got released from prison.
Amazing. Do you know what, when you said that, lying on the mat feeling that this was the point at which you had reached and achieved everything that you'd wanted early in life, it sounded somewhat equivalent to that moment when you saw all that money on the table.
That's the thing, man. Like that's the one, like, obviously, like, you can't live your life through regret, and you can't, like, you learn from every negative experience, and every experience I've ever been through in my life, I've always looked back on it now and gone, it's the best thing. Like, if you asked me the question now and you said, do you regret spending 10 years of my life on earth in prison, in a 12 by 6 foot cell? I regret what I did to do that, to go in that place. If you said to me, I don't need to do that, I would still want to go through that journey because I would not be the person I've ended up becoming today. Because those life experiences and the things I've seen and the people I've interacted with throughout that journey of being in prison for all those years, all those different characters of people and how it shaped my outlook on life, I wouldn't change that part of it. I would go through that journey still. I would still go through that 10 years, and because it's made me the person I am today. When you look back and you go,
yeah, of course. Yeah.
Could I have gone to the Olympics if someone would have picked me up? Maybe.
But I think that's very encouraging, if you like, for people going through any tough time that you just don't know. You might look back and what at the time is really brutal, it might end up being the absolute making of you. You just don't know at the time. And obviously, whether we leap to conclusions about what other people are like because of things they've done, or leaping to conclusions about a period of time that we're going through at the moment, we just don't know. You know, we're too quick to accept how our mind interprets things. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I totally do. I totally do. Like, and even like the situation that we're all in at the moment, like the situation with lockdown and COVID, and it's had an impact over my life. Like, it's made me, I started assessing stuff, like stuff I was doing, people I was doing stuff with. Was I really happy? Was it really adding to my life, or was it subtracting away from my life? And I've always, since I've gone through that process of wanting something different, not change, but wanting something different for my life, when I look at an individual or a person or a purpose or a company and I'm engaging with them, are they adding value to my life? Are they going to make me happy and content, or are they subtracting? And then when stuff happened around the COVID situation and there was the lockdowns, it made me assess the people that I, because sometimes you can sleepwalk into things, relationships with people, and you don't realize actually they're not really benefiting you that much. Like, you're not really getting, they're not adding to your life, they're actually taking away, they're making you feel negative about things. I went through a process where I started cutting away from individuals and situations where it wasn't making me feel content, but I needed to go through that process like we're all going through at the moment. And I use it as a moment of reflection to do something a bit different with my life and tidy my life up a little bit, because I've got to the point now where I'm uncompromising on me being content as a human, because I know it sounds quite morbid and some of my friends laugh at me when I say this. But like, if I'm lucky, I've probably got 40 summers left on this earth and 40 Christmases, even though I don't really celebrate Christmas. But I'm not wasting that time that I've got on earth, because once it's gone, it's gone. Like, I'm never going to be able to get it back. And I don't want to live my life through regret. I want to be content. I want to be positive to the world. I want to have a positive impact. I want to help people. But I want to be content and I want to feel fulfilled and happy in my own existence on earth, because we're not on this planet forever. We're not going to live forever. It's right. Such a short, minute amount of time that we're here. Like, you can't be compromising on your happiness and your contentment in life, because once it's gone, it's gone, and we would never be able to get it back again.
Totally. I don't think that's morbid. In fact, I'm sure you're a fan of stoicism. I'd certainly imagine so. But I interviewed Ryan Holiday, who's a bit of a legend in the Stoic scene, shall we say, and he carries around a coin in his pocket that says memento mori on it. Remember, you're going to die. Reflect on your mortality. The reason being, exactly like you said, because it makes then the precious moments that we have, it makes them much more valuable, because they're not going to go on forever. So yeah, I think actually reflecting on your mortality, if people did more of it, perhaps we would live life differently. And I think in terms of COVID now, obviously it's incredibly hard time for people in terms of, the illness itself, people dying, hospitals, job losses, all this kind of thing. But we just don't know that in 10 years' time, in terms of society more broadly, we don't know whether it's going to end up having a positive effect or a negative effect. We just don't know.
No, we don't. We don't. And I do think out of this situation, there'd be a lot of growth for people. Yeah. I know personally through some of my friends that, like, it's the trajectory of their lives. That moment of reflection and pausing, they've looked at stuff and gone, actually, I'm not really happy doing what I'm doing every day. I don't want my life to go back to sitting on the tube. Like going to work, doing a job I don't really like that much, don't really feeling like I'm valued that much. And it's been a catalyst for them deciding to go off and do different things. And I do think it will have a positive effect over some people's lives. I do understand on the flip side of that, that there's a lot of people that are struggling just to even put food on the table.
But
I do think there are individuals where it can have a profound impact over their lives in a positive way, where it could change the way that the rest of their lives unfold.
Absolutely. Right. As I said, I'm conscious of your time, John. You're very generous with it. But so I'll rattle through a couple of the other bits. So from this point, so you've broken world records. You've been a model inmate. You knew that you wanted to get out. I know that, when you got to your 5-year term limit, you went to see the guy who sat on the parole board and he said, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And you said, you got to be a professional athlete. And he basically sat back in his chair and laughed and said, I've never heard that one before. And unfortunately, what was it? It was another 2 years, wasn't it, before you got out from that point?
Yes, it was. It was. Yeah, I thought it was going to be a shoo-in. I thought I was going to turn up. And I thought, if there was ever going to be a home run hit to get a parole, I thought I'd done it. And he just sat back and he started smiling. He said, the words that he used, he said, my release plan wasn't based in reality.
That's a really revealing comment, isn't it? Don't believe people who tell you things aren't realistic. And if anyone could prove it, that's you. So then you ended up getting out though. And something I found really interesting, John, was when you spoke about it being having this sort of sense of anticlimax when you got out, this moment that you'd built up in your head as this huge moment that was going to come. And this, I think, is quite revealing for anyone as well, because I've spoken to people who've dedicated their lives to winning, let's say, World Cups or anything like that, or people in normal life to getting a certain job or to getting a certain relationship, and then they get it and actually, hang on, I don't feel like I expected to feel. So I thought this was obviously, again, with you, it tends to be a bit heightened and a bit more dramatic than norm. But actually, this is quite a revealing feeling that you went through at this point as well.
Yeah, it's quite an anti-climax, if I'm honest. Like you get told you're going to get released, and you kind of think it's going to be like this sunny, magical day, and you're going to walk out the gate, and your life is just going to be amazing. It's like ended, it's finished, that part of it's done. And you go down to the reception and you fill all the paperwork in and they open up the gate and you walk out and it's raining and it's quite anticlimactic. Like, it isn't how you think it's going to be. Because bear in mind, for years and years and years, you fixate on a date. You fixate on a date on a calendar. That's when you're going to get out. It's very important when you're in that situation that you also keep yourself in the present and the moment, because if that date isn't for a long time, that can also sort of have a negative impact over you. So in my regard, it's all about keeping myself in the moment, in the present, and being the best person I could be that day in that environment. That was when I made the decision to be an athlete. So it was about putting the building blocks in place. But yeah, like when I got out, it wasn't that sort of like incredible moment. There was an element of relief. It felt like I could close the chapter on that part of my life to a degree, because it never really closes with the sentence that I got, because I got a life sentence. I'm technically serving my sentence now in the community. Even though I've been out for 8 years, that life sentence will always hang over my head because you technically sign your life over to the state. So at any moment, if they believed that I was involved in any sort of criminal activity, I could be recalled back to prison. People don't understand that with life sentences. They just think, why do people get out? But it's because when you do get out, you're on life license, so they can recall you back. Okay. But the actual part of when I got out, yeah, it was... One thing I would say, what did throw me a little bit was choice, because I've always been quite a decisive person. But when I first got released, it was choice. I wasn't used to having so much choice. And I remember going into shops and I could buy any colour I wanted. I'd go to a restaurant and eat any food I wanted. And that sort of threw me a little bit for a little while. And also, like, the regimen of eating at certain times of the day, I had to consciously stop myself from eating breakfast at sort of 7 a.m. and eating lunch at 11:30 a.m. and eating dinner at 4:30 p.m. Sorry. But I had to get out of that, because, again, you don't realise you do start becoming institutionalised. Even though I consciously, when I was in there, tried to stop that from happening to me, there are certain things where you don't even realise it's had an impact over you until you get out.
Yeah. Now, we spoke about the impact of environment, and I know you joined a rowing club immediately, which you've touched on already. And obviously, you were welcomed into it. Clearly, you had a lot of talent, you know, although you kept your world records to yourself. But this was obviously really integral, wasn't it? And I think you may have said this already, in terms of you were able to completely change the environment in terms of the people you spent your time with, because you are now with developing these relationships with people who also valued sport. And this is the beauty power of sport. So you had all these new friendships, you would join the rowing club. How long after that did you write the blog that I've read where you came clean about everything?
So I was at the rowing club for about around four and a half months when I joined. So there was a couple of things, like, obviously, because rowing is lots of it's done on ergometers, so indoor rowing machines. Yeah. People could see I wasn't some random guy that just wanted to suddenly learn how to row in a boat. Like, they could see the numbers I was putting out, like, they were quick. So, like, people were very inquisitive about my sporting background. And I was trying to, again, be very guarded around it. But it's one of these things, isn't it? Once people really start seeing how sort of the raw talent that you've got, and like, where's this guy come from? Why is he so good? I found out that maybe someone may have found out about my past. And then I just thought, right, I need to claim ownership of this. And I spoke to one of my really good friends, and me and him sat down, and he said, look, you have to make a decision. Do you want the narrative to be how they want that narrative to be? Or do you want to take a bit of control around the narrative and explain it? And what it will be, it will be. They're either like you or they won't like you. Now, at this point, I was concerned because I wanted my life to be different. I've developed relationships with these people. I loved the sport. I loved everything about it. I loved the relationships that I did build up. I loved the club. And I was worried that sort of I'd be shunned. So I wrote this blog and I published it. And it went viral around rowing, in British rowing in particular. And the response was incredible. Like, it was so heartwarming and touching, the support I was shown. And then what it actually did, ironically, people then really wanted to help me be successful and succeed. And that was, again, one of the few times in my life where I had it, where someone wanted me to be successful, not necessarily just for something that was going to benefit them later on down the road. And yeah, like the way I was welcomed in within the community, even more so after it come out, was incredible. And even though I don't row anymore, like, I've still got these relationships, and that rowing club, London Rowing Club, has been such a fundamental pillar of my life. And again, like, when I got out, I just thought I was going to go to a sports club and just be an athlete. I didn't realize actually how that support structure would aid me in growing and developing, and the people that aided me and developed me and supported me in that journey, how fundamental that would be to me staying out of prison, me being a successful member of society, and sort of carrying on the journey that I've been on up to this date.
And it's an amazing journey. And so you said you don't row anymore, so you're an Ironman athlete. How did it go from there then to becoming like one of the only Nike-sponsored athletes, Ironman athletes, certainly in Britain, aren't you? One of only two,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, it's a very sort of like, again, the way sort of my life's unfolded, it's been quite a unique situation. But basically, I didn't know this at the time. So I one day randomly got sent an email to my website, and my friend Terry helps me run my website. So like, when traffic comes to it, he basically filters it, and any personal messages he send across to me, and any sort of like any work stuff he will deal with. And then he'll come back to me and say, someone's asked, could you go to this school talk? Could you do this? Could you do that? And then he rang me up one day and he said, I've got something to tell you that could change your life. So I said, okay. I mean, what is it? And he went, right, if you could work with anyone in the world, who would it be? And he teeing that up. And I was like, I can't think. And then he said, so we've had an email from Nike. And I was like, there's no way that's happened. And he said, I promise you it has. So I said, forward me the email. So he forwarded it on and I read it. It wasn't very descriptive. It was basically, hired, his name is called Dan Smith. I work in sports marketing at Nike UK.
I know Dan.
Oh, do you know him?
Yeah.
So we've become really good mates now. Like, he invited me to his wedding and stuff. So he sends this email. And obviously, I don't know at the beginning how this sort of played itself out. And that, so I think Dan is Nike. That's who I think, marketing guy. So anyway, he basically says, very short email, we would love to work with you. Have you got any contractual obligations to any other brand? And I didn't really work with anyone else. We'd be interested to have a conversation with you. So Terry said, do you want to email him back or shall I? I said, look, I reckon it's probably best you do it because you're far more business minded than I am. Have a chat with him, see what he says. So he emails him back, goes quiet for months. And then obviously, I really wanted it to happen because to me, being a Nike athlete is like the pinnacle of being under that umbrella with like LeBron James.
Michael Jordan,
exactly. Like you're at the very pinnacle of sport, like some of the greatest sports stars that have ever walked the planet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So for me to come from where I've come from, to be under that umbrella, meant so much to me that I really wanted it to happen. Anyway, Dan ends up responding back. It was like late December, early Jan. And he said, could I come in and speak to the staff in Nike UK so they could get to meet me? So I went and done this talk in near Soho. Yeah. And then a week after that, they asked me then to go out to the Netherlands to speak at one of their big European conferences to 800 members of staff. So I agreed to do it. It allowed me to leave the United Kingdom because Nike wrote me the cover note to send to my probation officer. So she then let me leave the country because I said it was for work. So again, I got into my probation office with this letter from Nike to say, we request that John McAvoy can come out to Hilversum in the Netherlands to deliver this speech to our employees at our European headquarters. So when I go out there, I meet the European VP, European director, a marketing director of Nike. And he was basically like one of the most powerful men at Nike, but most powerful man in Nike Europe. Then the story then starts coming out. So he was in an airport at Schiphol, and he had opened up an English newspaper, which he never normally reads. And in the sports section, I did an interview in the Telegraph, and he said he read half the interview. He put the newspaper down. He sent an email to Nike UK and said, find that man and sponsor him. And anyway, he's telling the story around the table with Dan and stuff. And then it all made sense. So when Dan gets this email, it was so out of protocol, because normally like Nike have got scouts. Yeah. They do all this stuff. And then suddenly one of the most senior men at Nike sends a direct email in and says, I want this man, get him. And I want him. So obviously Dan didn't know what Iron Man was. He didn't know who I was. He knew nothing about me whatsoever. But he was the one that had to sort of get me in and stuff. Yeah. But it was basically Edgar reading about me in a newspaper in the Netherlands, an English newspaper in the Netherlands, waiting to fly out to New York from Schiphol Airport.
That's amazing. That is amazing, isn't it? It does have that preordained feel about it. So, right, here we are. We're up to pretty much the present day. You know, you're a Nike-sponsored athlete. You're a competitive elite Ironman athlete. But what I'm really interested in as well, though, is how your currency, if you like, your values about what really is important has changed. Because what you had early on in terms of wanting all the money, the way you went about it, obviously, is a little bit off the normal track, shall we say. But that is a very, very normal goal for people to have. Understandably, that's the system in which we live. But now, so you work with Greenhouse Sports, helping kids from disadvantaged backgrounds through sport. And I know you nearly burnt yourself out at one point with the amount of times you were going into schools and doing all these kind of talks. But having valued money so highly previously, what have you learned along your journey? And what is, in your opinion now, the greatest currency?
So I made a promise to myself when I decided I wanted to do something different in my life. Money was my God up until the age of 26 years old. I valued everything through a monetary sort of lens. It was so detrimental and corrosive to my life. It destroyed my life. It cost my friend his life. My stepdad's never seen the light of day since 2004. He's still in prison to this day. So because I've had that very negative interaction with what money is, I made a promise to myself that money would never be my God ever again. And I got released when I come out and I had nothing. And I mean nothing. I was sleeping in my mum's spare bedroom. All of the assets that I had before I went to prison, I gave them away. I had watches that I didn't want to take anything from my past into my future. So I just relinquished a lot of it and let go of it. And I went to rebuild my life from scratch in a new world, in a new life. And I totally understand how people sometimes get submerged into the hamster wheel of the money. And I see it because the society in which we live in, it's like you need to have that car, you need to have that watch, you need to have a house, you need to have two kids, you need to have all these things. And that's going to make you feel complete as a person. And then what ends up happening, you become removed from who you are and you end up going into a world and doing stuff that you don't really want to do to live up to that image of what you're being told is how you should live your life. Me personally, in my own journey, the way my relationship's been with money, I want my life to feel complete and happy in where I am and who I'm around and what I'm doing every day. And I come to the conclusion that money isn't it. It isn't the watches. And years ago, like when I did have nice things, it's very vacuous. You feel good for a couple of hours, a couple of days, a couple of weeks, and you're constantly looking for the next upgrade, the next new thing, and you fall into this cycle and this trap of always constantly wanting more and more and more. So I try to relinquish as much stuff as I can in my life and just try to live the simplest life I can. And that makes me feel happy and content. Like doing stuff, like when I go and ride my bike in the mountains or I'll go running or swimming, and it doesn't cost me any money, but the joy and happiness it brings me as a person. Like, I don't earn that much money each year. Like, believe me, people, you think when you sign these contracts with Nike and stuff, like, you're like a football player and you earn millions. And I really don't. I really don't earn anything like that. But I honestly can say I am the happiest and most content I've ever been in my life with the least amount of stuff that I've ever probably had. And it's all about the pleasures and joys of making sure that every day I get up, I am really content and at ease in what I'm about to do today. I don't look myself in the mirror. And if I did ever look myself in the mirror, and Steve Jobs said it, and for too many days consistently, you go, I don't feel happy in what I'm doing, stop doing it. Because life is too short and it's too precious. And life is the most precious commodity that any of us will ever own. So why sacrifice life for things that realistically aren't really going to make you that happy, when you can have more life experiences and more joy and pleasure in your life by spending more time with people that you love? And because then you don't need that much stuff in life to be happy. A lot of societies, we've evolved because of we've been told that we need this stuff to make ourselves happy, and we really, really don't.
Yeah, totally. In terms of as well putting back and, you know, being a positive influence on, for example, people who have had difficult environments in which they've grown up in, taking the example of Greenhouse, how valuable is the kind of work that you do with a charity like that, or some of the other work you do in terms of going into prisons or schools or whatever and making a positive impact on other people's lives? How valuable is that to you?
Yeah, like going back to when I was a kid, legacy. Now, legacy was always intrinsically linked to me by wealth. It was always intrinsically linked into your reputation, what I'm going to be remembered for when I die. I want to be a good athlete, because when I break X amount of world records and run ridiculously fast marathons, that's going to make me feel like that's going to be my legacy. When I die, I'm going to be remembered for doing that. And what I come to realize is actually legacy is about the impact that you have over other people's lives. Because when I'm gone, like realistically, times on a ball don't really mean much. But when I'm gone, if I've positively impacted over someone's life where their life is then better and their children's lives better, a legacy is like a living organism. It just keeps going on and on and on. If you have that experience with another human, another person, you have that interconnection that you've changed the trajectory of someone else's life. Now, I know it sounds, again, a little bit cheesy, but if I can stop just one person or just create an awareness in another person that I don't want to live my life like this, I want to do something else. Like, if he's managed to do what he's done with his life and come from, like, the bottom of nowhere, like the deepest, darkest hole you could be physically buried in, and get to where I got to. And Simon, I am no different to anyone else. The difference is, with a lot of people, you just need to make the choice and go, I don't want this no more, and I'm going to find a way to not being the person I am now. I want to be something else. And that is all I did. I just made a set of choices. I woke up one morning and said, I do not want to live this life no more. What can I do? How can I get out of this? And I found solutions to those problems. I was saying it to someone yesterday. When I was in prison, I was given an 89% chance when I got released, I'd be back in prison within 2 years. That is the statistic they gave me. It's called an OASIS. It's like they put all these numbers into a computer system, like your criminal records and your education level, and if you've got a drug problem. And I beat the odds. But I knew I'd beat the odds because I was determined that that was not going to be my life. So to me, legacy is about having that positive impact over young people's lives and demonstrating to them it doesn't matter where you come from in life, it's where you end up that counts. And if one person just takes one thing out of my life and they don't end up making the same poor life choices that I did as a young person, and they look at my life and go, actually, if he had that talent in his body, imagine the talents I might have in my body at 14 right now, that if I use them and express them, I might be able to go and achieve something with my life that doesn't necessarily mean me wasting my life going down the wrong negative path.
Mm. I love that, redefining legacy. It's easy to think of it in terms of, you know, a reputation, how you're going to be remembered, wanting to be idolized, having that big portrait, you know, in some important building somewhere. But actually, it's less about yourself, is what you're saying. But actually, a legacy is about passing it on and impacting other people. And like I said, I love that, a living organism, as you say. I think that's a lovely, new, fresh way of looking at legacy.
Thank you, mate.
Well, listen, John, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. It really has. Your story is amazing. The example you show, the work you're now doing in terms of impacting other people and leaving a legacy. And even though your lessons are far out there because of the experiences you've had, actually, in terms of the value of money, the value of legacy, et cetera, all those things, actually, they're very relatable to anyone. So I just want to say thank you for coming on. And it's been just a joy listening to them and for sharing your lessons, and just congratulate you for what you've achieved and how you've turned your life around. It just is an incredible, incredible story. So thank you very much.
Thank you, mate. Take care, everyone.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening. And if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.